Colonel Rob Maness has a lifelong record of providing dedicated service to this nation. Having worked his way up from the enlisted ranks to full colonel, he served our country for more than 32 years. He has served as a bomber squadron commander, bomb disposal technician, Joint Chiefs of Staff Operations Officer, assisted the National Security Team with the campaign plan for the Global War on Terrorism. He authored the first theater nuclear war plan and served as the vice commander of America's largest airborne intelligence wing. Colonel Rob Maness is a true American hero. This is Rob Maness Live.
Tom, we followed the Oath Keeper 1, 2, and 3 trials very closely. And matter of fact, we were there for closing arguments of the Oath Keeper 1 trial. A question that I always had was, what were you doing there? You weren't an Oath Keeper. You weren't in the leadership of the Oath Keepers. But for some reason, and the prosecution knew this like a month after the whole thing started. What the hell were you even doing in that trial? Help me wrap my head around that, because it's a question that I've had for now 3 years.
There's no easy answer for that, and that's something that's kept Sharon and me awake for a long time. In fact, my fellow defendants at the table would be talking, the defense table, they would be talking to their attorneys and saying the same thing. What's Caldwell doing here? He's not one of us. But what happened was is that the FBI and the DOJ had targeted me. They had a rush to judgment because I knew a couple of the Oath Keepers. So you could say it was guilt by association. And the Department of Justice and the FBI put out statements through the press saying that I was the big cheese. I was the top banana. It was my orders that caused the insurrection at the Capitol. And they went so far as to say that, in fact, the commander of the Oath Keepers. All of this because somebody had said that Tom was a commander. I was a lieutenant commander in the Navy. We all know that veterans like to refer to each other by the rank that they held on active duty. Since the DOJ and the FBI know nothing about being on active duty or actual service to our country, nothing about the military. In fact, they hate the military, and that came out during the trial. They jumped to conclusions. But once they had her on a limb, their reputation at stake. You see, Washington, D.C. is not like any other place, and I know because I did three tours. That guy was born there. The only thing worse than being just because you're a boob in Washington is to be found as being wrong about something in Washington. You don't get invited to the martini bar and get to rub elbows with the right people. So who does it tick?
Friends, welcome back to the Rob Maness Show. It's Whistleblower Wednesday, and we're live on Worldview Tube and our X Spaces simulcast. And folks, today we're bringing you that story right there that should shake every American to their core. It's a true January 6th story of corruption, persecution, survival, and ultimate victory. Our guest is that man, retired U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander Thomas Caldwell, a decorated veteran who honorably served our nation for nearly 20 years, two decades, mostly in the intelligence community. He's a former radio personality, a humorist, an artist, and a conservationist who, until that fateful day, lived a very quiet life with his wife, Sharon, on their family farm in Berryville, Virginia, deep in the Shenandoah Valley. But 2 weeks after January 6, 2021, that peace of that idyllic farm was shattered. Armored vehicles and federal agents showed up to arrest an innocent, elderly, disabled veteran, a man the government knew had committed no crime. Tom was charged with conspiracy, falsely accused of leading an insurrection as part of the Oath Keepers as their commander. Prosecutors demanded he spend the rest of his life in prison. For nearly 2 months, he endured solitary confinement. That's at the very beginning. He was denied medicine and medical care. He suffered physical abuse and total isolation while his farm was raided, his credit cards were canceled, his retirement and health coverage were stripped away. Four long years of lawfare followed that. And yet through it all, Tom's unshakable Christian faith, his wife's steadfast love, and the power of prayer carried him through. He was acquitted outright of four felony charges and received a full presidential pardon from President Trump in March of 2025. He tells the whole story in his powerful book, The Mouths of the Wicked, an eyewitness account that serves as both a warning and a testament to the indomitability of faith. Tom, welcome to the Rob Maness Show, sir. Thank you for your service and your sacrifice
and your courage. Thank you for saying that. Thank you. It's an honor to be with you, Colonel.
It takes courage to fight back like you guys have. And I've had the pleasure and honor of meet both of you guys personally and talk to you in person. And the book is fantastic. Thank you for sending me a signed copy. Mine is over my shoulder here. I'll send you a signed copy. It just came out almost 2 weeks ago. I've joined the author club.
That's terrific. And Sharon said that I should be sure to punk you for an autographed copy. So you've already punked yourself. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's on the way.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thanks for agreeing to come on. You know, we had talked about doing this a while back, and I've been in and out and everything, but I had this opening up today, and I was thinking maybe it was probably going to be August or September based on what you and I were talking about. But now we get to do this now, and it's important to get this back in front of the American people and keep it there. And the reason you're going to see several clips, folks, throughout the show today, as you always see, but you're going to see people with very big audiences interviewing Tom and hear what they had to say about this. So it's not like we're not trying to get it out there. And some of the biggest of the biggest have done that. And we're going to continue to do that. So, Tom, I covered a little bit of the stuff in my opening monologue, but just why were you there? I guess is my big question. Before we get into the whole Oath Keeper thing and all that stuff, why were you and Sharon were both there, right? On January
6th? That's correct. Yeah. And she calls it a husband and wife thing. It was actually her idea, so I could always blame her if I wanted to get into that sort of thing. But it was an historic occasion. It was a sitting president who was making his last address. I voted for the guy. He didn't win. Regardless of shenanigans, we thought we'd like to go. We'd never been to a Trump rally per se. And, you know, Washington, D.C. is the city of my birth. Why not go to Washington and say goodbye to a gentleman that we thought had done a pretty fine job? A lot of your viewers may not know, although many of them are quite sophisticated, that there were many conservative and Christian speakers who were scheduled to address crowds on the grounds of the Capitol building that very day. So that is why so many people left the Ellipse, for the people that are uninitiated. That's the southern part of the White House grounds. After the president was done speaking, that's why they left and went to the Capitol. It wasn't to burn the place down or have an insurrection. It was to hear other people. And the Honorable Mayor Muriel Bowser had issued permits for those speakers to address the crowd. So that was the deal. I am a disabled veteran. I stumped down Constitution Avenue. That's about the longest mile I ever made. Mm-hmm. It was very cold that day, and I was stumping along with my combination cane and flagstaff with my American flag proudly by my side. Sharon and I got down to the Capitol building and never even went on the Capitol grounds. For most of the day, we sat at a place called the Peace Monument or the Peace Fountain, which is not on the grounds, and a very famous place. Of course, it was wintertime, so it was a dry fountain. There were no seats down there, no park benches. So I parked my keister right there on the concrete, and that's where we spent most of the day. We were about 3 football field lengths away from the Capitol. We saw no violence. We participated in no violence. We weren't there to protest anything. We broke no laws. Imagine our surprise when the FBI came a-storming into our farm.
Yeah, that's incredible. So let me ask you this, since you brought up the other speakers and everything. Do you know what the layout was of the various stages? Because it's my understanding there were somewhere between 4 and 6 other speaking events around the Capitol building that had been permitted on Capitol grounds by, as you said, Bowser, Mayor Bowser.
Right. I think the vast majority were on the eastern side of the Capitol building. For people that don't know the orientation there, Constitution Avenue will run from west to east as you leave the Potomac River, and it takes you right to the side of the U.S. Capitol that is the most famous one. It is the place upon which the parapet is that the presidents are sworn into office. Mm-hmm. That is the view that people normally have in their minds when you say the U.S. Capitol. I believe that most of the stages were set up on the other side, that there's more concrete on the other side and more block upon which these things could reside. On the side that Sharon and I were on, it's mostly a grassy field. It's a lawn, actually, where I played as a child when my family would have picnics on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol. I should point out that there were no barriers. There were no signs saying, don't get on the grass, don't get close to the Capitol. And we would have had a hard time getting to the Capitol just because of how many people were there. But the direct answer to your question is, I know of only one stage that was on the west side, the side where Sharon and I were.
Yeah. And the scaffolding that was up was there in preparation for the inauguration, right? Coming up in a couple of weeks.
Right, sir. That's where they would hang lights and speakers so that people all around that area could hear the goings on.
But you guys never even got close to that area.
Well, after we got word and it passed through the crowd, this was about a little bit before 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that Congress had left the building. Mm-hmm. We didn't know that they left the building for any other reason than maybe they were done. I would say to most people, if you could have explained to me the process of certification of the Electoral College prior to January 6, 2021, I would have given you the Cupid doll because I had no idea. So people said, well, I guess it's over. Those people who thought that the 7th Cavalry was going to come over the hill and President Trump was still going to be our president, they were disappointed. And so many people were leaving, and yet there were folks that said, you know what? Why don't we go up on the inaugural balcony? This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to stand there where people like Stokely Carmichael, John Kerry had addressed crowds. Let's go up there where the presidents are and take some pictures of what we used to call in the Navy some happy snaps. Yeah. And so Sharon and I, shoulder to shoulder with people, kind of waddled our way up there like so many emperor penguins, made it up the stairs, got to the balcony. We were there for a total of 5 minutes. We can prove it because I have the most exhaustive pictorial history of what we did that day of anybody you're ever going to meet. Over 200 pictures and videos. We were there for 5 minutes. And even on the government's own video, you can see us every single minute doing nothing wrong. And me actually gesturing emphatically, here is the way down. Because we couldn't get down the same way we came up, there were more and more people packing in behind. Yeah. So we were there for a total of 5 minutes. We got down, we went back to our car, and that was it.
I'm laughing, not because I think it's funny. It's because it's the reaction of somebody that's been observing this and interacting with January 6th. I call you guys victims. I know that's probably not the right thing to do, but you are victims of weaponized government. There are very few people that actually broke anything or did anything. You're in that crowd that nothing should have happened. Nothing should
exactly
have happened to you.
We agree with that. But you know what? The life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans.
That's right. That's right. Well, we got to take a commercial break. When we come back, we'll see another video of you. I think it's of you. But I want to talk about the specific charges, why you titled the book the way you titled it. I think it's very interesting, and people need to understand why the book title is The Mouths of the Wicked. I want you to talk about what the government actually knew and what they didn't know. We'll be right back with retired Lieutenant Commander Thomas Caldwell.
Friends, this is Brandon House. For more than a year now, I've been teaching through the Book of Revelation, and the response from you has been overwhelming. You've asked me again and again, when are you going to put this study in print? We want to mark it up. We want to share it with our families. Well, it's here. My brand new two-volume commentary on the book of Revelation, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is not a watered-down, allegorized, replacement theology approach to Revelation. This is a literal, grammatical, historical study, the way the Lord intended his word to be read. And I connect the prophecy of Revelation to the headlines you're watching unfold right now, the rise of global government and the convergence of end-time events the Lord Jesus warned us about. Folks, we are living in serious days, and there has never been a more important time to understand what God has told us about what is coming. Get your two-volume Revelation commentary today at worldviewstore.com. That's worldviewstore.com.
Everything we've been saying from day one about J6 is true. And, you know, there was Antifa present. John Sullivan knew it was going to happen. This was a setup. And there were Antifa and FBI agents actually outside, you know, and with people on the other side breaking windows of the Capitol. It wasn't Trump supporters. It wasn't your average J6er there. And, you know, also the Oath Keepers. I've interacted with Oath Keepers for decades. And, you know, they were salt of the earth. They were retired cops and firefighters. But you were never a member of the Oath Keepers. You never entered the Capitol. You never planned an attack. And the government has admitted this, right?
That's absolutely true. And they knew very early on that they had gotten it wrong. And yet they came after me like they came after no one else. They said that I was the top banana, the big cheese, that I was the mastermind of January 6th, even though they did absolutely no investigation on me whatsoever before they sent a SWAT team to our farm in Virginia, nearly killed my darling wife on the front porch of our home, and then dragged me away to solitary confinement. So one of the things that was really chilling was my very first lawyer said, the DOJ knows that you're innocent, but you know what? They don't care.
They don't care. It's unbelievable, the weaponization of the United States government against innocent Americans. And in this case, Tom Caldwell is a disabled American veteran. He served his country. He's a decorated veteran. He's worked in the intelligence field for many, many years. So he's done the hard work to protect the United States of America. And this is how he is repaid. You know, folks, if you're hearing about the weaponization fund and it's going to be killed by Congress, you need to write and call your congressman and get on every single day until they back off of that, because the president of the United States is correct. Folks have to have a way of being reinstated and refreshed so they can get their lives back. And my guest today is the author of the book, The Mouths of the Wicked, Tom Caldwell. And he's with us today to talk about this. Tom, look, man, let's talk about the title of the book. Why The Mouths of the Wicked? Before we go too much.
Well, the biggest reason, there's actually two, if you'll permit me. It's sort of, the book sort of wrote itself as I lived through it, because I started making notes and smuggling things out of prison to share and thinking those would be the last words that anybody in our society would ever hear from me. I was in solitary confinement. I was putting up with a lot of abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. They put you in darkness for days at a time. It was an ice cold 6x9 concrete box with a solid steel door. They really made it hard on me. And they wanted to break me down. They wanted me to admit to things that I didn't do, and to bear false witness against other people, people that I didn't even know. They said, well, we'll stop the pain if you'll just play ball. And I wouldn't do it.
And they were talking about, wait a minute, they were talking about you being in solitary confinement when they were asking you to do that?
Oh, sure. They would come and they would go through my attorney, or they would send somebody, a representative, to talk through the bulletproof glass. You have a little square door that has a solid cover that they can close up, so you're totally closed in there. Or they open it up and they say, look, you just need to play ball. You just need to talk. You just need to sign these papers. It's very much like the Stasi, the East German Stasi. But
and these are the American Department of Justice federal prosecutors.
That's right. That's right. And so I knew that I needed to get into and stay in Word, Colonel. The most precious times in that terrible tomb that I was in was when they would take a dirty old handset, kind that you would get off of a garage or a gas station payphone in the old days, and they'd stick it through a little slot in the door, and I could hear my darling wife's voice. And we would pray together. They would never miss an opportunity to mock my faith after those calls were over. But I knew that I needed to get into the Word, and so I would ask again and again. Of course, I wasn't allowed to go out and go to the library. I would ask again and again for a Bible. So finally, one night, in the middle of the night, there was a guard who had a weak moment, and when he passed by, I said, "Do you think that you could give me a Bible?" When I got the Bible, I'll tell you what, I snatched that thing through the hole in that steel door as if it was life itself. And I sat down on the floor. We used to call it Indian fashion back in the day. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I opened up the holy book. I just let it fall open to wherever it might. And I was saying at the time, as I'd said many days while I was in there, "God, no one knows what Sharon and I are going through," because she was going through a hell of her own, trying to get me an attorney, trying to get me out. And when the Bible opened up, it opened to Psalm 109, and my eyes fell upon the mouths of the wicked and the mouths of the deceitful are open against me. They speak of me with a lying tongue. And I knew then, it was almost like God said, "Nobody knows. Nobody knows what you're going through. Take heart. Have faith. I told you to be courageous. Hang tough." And that stayed with me. When I went to try to come up with a title for the book, after all of these years, that came back to me for that reason. And also, there was never any evidence that I had done anything wrong. There was nothing but false testimony, perjured testimony, manufactured false exhibits, and the stuff viewed from the fantasy and the mouths of the wicked pastors.
Yeah, Tom. We're getting some rubber banding, so if I lose you, we'll bring you back in. But, you know, this is incredible, because when I hear you speak about the experience firsthand, about being threatened or being given the opportunity to stop the pain. You're a disabled veteran. Can you talk about, if you're able to, talk about the physical condition that you were in at the time when this happened? Well, it looks like we lost him, folks. Hopefully we'll get him back because this man's a disabled veteran. Now and at the time, he's a disabled veteran. Tom, I think we got you back.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So when you, what was your physical condition as a disabled veteran, if you can talk about that, at this time when they had you in the box?
Sure. Well, I was 66 years old when this all began. I've got my left arm reattached by virtue of a brass pin to my upper torso. It was blown loose. And so they totally reconstructed that. I also had my spine cracked in multiple vertebra, and multiple discs had been destroyed. And so my lower back had been put back together by some very good surgeons in a sort of a Jenga blocks kind of a thing. Yeah. I say, as a disabled veteran, I'm dependent upon prescription meds, notions, potions, and lotions to be able to have some kind of a life and be able to be participatory in that thing called life. And the first thing that happened when I was thrown in there, besides being roughed up and being chained up and all of that, was that they denied me all medical care. So all of my prescription meds were withheld from me, even though the prison instructed my darling wife to drive several hours the day of our arrest to bring me the medications that I would need for, quote, a few days, end quote. Some of those are controlled substances. I have no idea where they went. They might have been, sold or consumed by some of the guards at the prison. I don't know. But I never saw any of those.
So your wife brought them, and you never saw them?
That is correct. Yes, sir.
Yeah. That's incredible. So were you getting disability benefits in retirement from the VA?
Oh, Oh, absolutely. Yes, sir. And of course, one of the first things they wanted to do was stop those benefits. So they did. It was just part of their trying to squeeze us and trying to eliminate any funding that we would have to keep going, to keep the lights on, to keep doing any kind of farming, and to pay for an aggressive legal defense, which is what we needed.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the FBI raid, I want to talk a little bit more about that, that they nearly killed Sharon. Describe what happened there.
Well, after they dragged me across the front lawn of our house and threw me face down on the hood of a government vehicle and chained me, you know, double chains and put me in slave shackles and all that, that's when I looked back at the front door that I had exited, and they had called Sharon out in the bright lights, this glare, these spotlights, these searchlights they had. And she was standing there, and it was pretty breezy that January morning. She was standing in nothing but a nightshirt, and she had her arms out to the side, sort of like Jesus Christ on the cross. That was the first thing that struck me. And she had in her hands a pair of socks. She had a sock in each hand, and she just wanted to let her put her socks on her feet. She was so cold, and they were screaming and yelling and the epithets and all of that. And I just felt the tension ramping up. And that's when I saw the red laser dots of their M4 automatic rifle pointers all over her face and her chest. And it was the first time that I can remember in a long time that I called out audibly to our Heavenly Father. And I said, Abba Father, please don't let them murder my wife. Please don't let them kill my wife.
And what was the response?
The response was from God. He stayed their hands somehow. The giant FBI guy that was behind me snatched me away. I didn't even know for a long time whether she was alive. I kept fearing the hearing of that rifle report that would mean that my reason for living had ended. And they took me away, around the back of the house, threw me in a vehicle, and I asked over and over about Sharon's condition, and they laughed at me. They walked by and they laughed at me as I sat in what I call a government stink mobile that smelled like, stale coffee and government entitlement. But they snatched up Sharon and they roughed her up a little bit and took her in the house and stuck her on the couch. I think eventually they allowed her to get dressed, but it was a very traumatic thing. She doesn't talk about it very much.
So have you ever found out why they took the approach of swatting you guys so aggressively? I mean, what do you have, like a bazooka and an artillery, a 155 millimeter artillery piece, or maybe an A-10 at your house?
No,
I mean, what's the deal?
No, sir.
Any idea?
And they did that to us. But it was almost like we were one of the test cases because they did it to hundreds and hundreds of our fellow citizens. Yeah. I think they did it because, it's kind of a shock fun thing. Maybe they get together in the dark and they get fresh donuts from Krispy Kreme and then they go and they attack people. And it's like play dress up and take your guns out and point them at people and yuck a puck a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'm not the only one that they did that to, but I could not understand why they did that. Now, I'm a farmer. I've got a couple of firearms, at least I had, you got to have a shotgun and stuff like that.
Right.
But they weren't interested in any of that. In fact, they looked at it, they talked about it, but they never confiscated anything. No, what it was they wanted to make a statement. They wanted to come and they wanted to terrify us. And I can't help but make the connection to Vicki Weaver and Ruby Ridge. I thought that Sharon was going to get wiped out because you got these cowboys that are out there with their firearms, and you just don't draw down on somebody like that.
Yeah.
You just don't do it. And yet they did. She was innocent. She was practically nude. All she had was this thin nightshirt, and yet they're sticking their guns in her face.
That's absolutely right. We've got to take another break. When we come back, the first question I'm going to ask you is, have any of these jerks been held accountable? We'll be right back with Tom Caldwell.
At a certain age, you stop chasing younger. You start protecting what helps you feel steady, strong, and well. Your body's collagen matters. It supports the structure of your skin, joints, and connective tissue. But as the years go by, your body needs more support from the inside. That's where Bella Grace Elixir comes in. Bella Grace Elixir combines Verisol collagen, the world's most clinically proven collagen, with Astereal astaxanthin and cat's claw in a proprietary blend designed to help support the processes that reconstruct collagen, while also offering antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects. And this isn't just for women. It's for men and women who want to age with more confidence, more care, and a daily wellness routine that supports the body from within. One simple elixir, thoughtfully formulated for whole body wellness. Take care of the body that has carried you this far. Order Bella Grace Elixir today at melissahousebg.com.
For one, in a conspiracy, they said I conspired and I actually put together a military-style attack on the Capitol, that I stormed into the Capitol and did all these terrible things. They even claimed I threatened our lawfully elected representatives in Congress. Total claptrap. But they sent that information all around the world, across all the media platforms. Interestingly enough, while I was languishing in the prison in solitary confinement, not knowing when I was going to get out, Sharon found us our current lawyer, Mr. David Fisher. And David Fisher immediately started doing lawyer stuff, like looking for the truth and doing some research. And when he did that, he went to the government and he said, how's about showing me some evidence? And when they couldn't produce it, they immediately changed their position. Now they say the exact opposite of what they said. Originally, they claimed I was the commander of the Oath Keepers, that I did this terrible thing to go inside and I created a plan to attack Congress. Now they admit, no, Tom, you really didn't do that. You weren't the commander of the Oath Keepers, not a leader, not even a member. Now, they seem to be very nice people, but I'm not part of that organization. Then they continued to do their flip-flop, and they said, you know, I guess you didn't really go in, and I guess you didn't really develop a plan to attack. But still, Tucker, we're mired in a legal battle against the government with no end in sight. And what they're doing...
No end in sight. And that was on the Tucker Carlson Show back when he was on Fox News. So millions of people watching that audience. And I've showed you a series of interviews with the Caldwells on Real America's Voice Cowboy Logic Show, which has millions of viewers. On the David Zieri Show, which has millions of viewers. And now this is on Tucker Carlson, and with millions and millions and millions of viewers. So it's not like this hasn't been out there and the truth hasn't been out there. My guest is that man, Tom Caldwell, the author of The Mouths of the Wicked. You got to go get this book, folks, The Mouths of the Wicked. It tells the whole story. And this man was in intelligence. He's been a writer before. He's a storyteller. It's an exceptional story. First-hand experience of this tragedy of what happened to our beloved United States of America and our citizens who did nothing wrong. And Tom, what exactly, well, first of all, any of these jerks, these goons been held accountable?
Not that I can tell. Okay. The winds of change did come when President Trump was inaugurated, and I think some of the prosecutors at the Department of Justice saw that the tide had changed. A couple of them were demoted shortly after the administration came in, and then they slipped out the back door and they got jobs with the white shoe liberal law firms in D.C. and proudly proclaim on their resumes and on their website that they led the prosecution against the evil people who tried to overthrow the government and all of that. So there are also still some of the prosecutors that remain at the Department of Justice. Now, I don't want to say anything bad about the Attorney General. I'm not going to do that. That's not what I do as a Christian. And I certainly wish the best for him. He's an interim, and we wish the best for Pam Bondi before that. And also, we're hoping for the best for Kash Patel, too. But I must say it's a little frustrating because every single one of those people that participated not only in the SWAT and the takedown and the Gestapo interrogation of me in chains here at my farm, but also every single FBI special agent who perjured themselves in grand jury proceedings and at trial, a 10-and-a-half-week trial in Washington, through which I was drugged, every single one of them is still employed at the right hand of Cash Patel. Now, Cash has said, well, gee, I'm not going to fire somebody who was only following orders. But what we need to emphasize is the FBI agents involved in these violent takedowns volunteered for those things because they felt that it was career enhancing.
Yeah.
How else can you explain why an FBI special agent in an office in Florida gets on a plane and helps in a takedown in Washington State? And it was happening over and over again. We saw this at trial.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know, the real damning piece of this, Cash Patel, I'm talking to you, Mr. Director, is you have FBI agents that participated in this hit job at this farm on an elderly couple, one of which is a disabled American veteran, decorated American veteran. And they didn't, I challenge you, bring me the intel, Cash, come on this show and show me the intel that required them to use that level of force and that level of ridiculousness against this man and his wife. You can't do it and you won't do it because you don't have the intel and they're still working for us. All right, my taxes are paying their paycheck or their retirement if they got to get to retirement. And I demand to get some accountability on this because they're the ones, Tom, the ones on the ground at the tactical level that should have been saying, no, this is an unlawful order. We teach them to not obey unlawful orders, just like we teach our military personnel not to obey unlawful orders and to push back on it. And they didn't do it. That's the problem that I've had with this the whole time. So what did they actually charge you with? I think we've documented it pretty well that they didn't have anything on you guys.
That's right. Well, particularly for me, and I'm going to stay in my lane, particularly for me, they just kept shuffling the cards. They said, okay, well, we can't make that stick, so we'll come up with something else. Mm-hmm. So after a couple of years, I was dragged into court with four members of the actual Oath Keepers, two I had actually met and two I had never met, yet I was supposed to be the kingpin in telling these folks what to do. There were three conspiracy charges that were leveled against me and some of the other members, too. The most onerous, of course, being seditious conspiracy, which is their accusation that I was trying to overthrow the government that I spent my adult life trying to defend and the Constitution that's supposed to stand behind that government. And there was conspiracy to obstruct Congress, conspiracy to stop agents from performing their duties and all of that. And another thing that they charged me with was 1512C2. Boy, that's boring. What does that mean? Well, what your viewers need to know is 1512C2 was actually the Enron statute. Is anybody old enough to remember the Enron scandal where people lost so much of their retirement money? And it had to do with people shredding documents of financial crimes. But what the government did, what the DOJ did, was they unlawfully applied that and they used that so that they would have a felony to charge most J6ers. You see, otherwise they would have been guilty of trespassing. That's a ticket and a fine. At least it has been through my entire life as a Washingtonian and a Virginian. So they had to have something to throw people in prison that was a felony that they could hang 15 to 20 years over them. Now, fortunately, even though I was found guilty of that, and I'll just step back and say, smart legal minds had told me ahead of time and our attorney, look, you can't get a fair trial in Washington, D.C. Those jurors are going to convict every MAGA guy, every conservative guy, every Christian guy of at least something. So they did not buy the twaddle about the conspiracies, but they did go along with this 1512C2. Fortunately, 2 years later, the Supreme Court said, oh, this is an Enron statute. So they threw that out. So now I was down to one, and you'll love this. It had to do destroying evidence. Stay with me. The logic of the government was, since they couldn't find any evidence that I had done anything wrong, I must have destroyed it.
Oh.
Guilty. So that was the felony that I went to sentencing on before the Honorable Amit P. Mehta on January the 10th of 2025.
So let me see if I understand this correctly. They couldn't find any evidence because they didn't there wasn't any. So they accused you and charged you with destroying evidence, but they had to approve it for the jury to find you guilty. I mean, even with a straight face, even with leftists, you got to have a straight face on this. What was the evidence that they said they had?
Well, there really wasn't any. They said, well, he destroyed these five selfies that he took. These were exculpatory selfies that I sent to 35 different friends and family members. They said, oh, well, he deleted this from this one text message that was to someone who wasn't even found guilty of anything on January 6th. So there must be a lot of stuff that he destroyed because you can see he destroys stuff. That is the kind of anosognosia that's taken over these people. The fact that they cannot conceive that something they believe deeply could possibly be wrong.
Yeah. But they still tried you along with Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers, right?
They certainly did, yes. And many of the charges that they levied against me were also levied against those folks. I was there with them for a 10-and-a-half-week trial. I had the benefit of, you look at it in hindsight, it's a benefit now. When I wrote this book, I still had and still have all of the evidence, the phony evidence, the exculpatory evidence that the judge wouldn't let the jury hear, all of the transcripts, not only for me, but for my co-defendants. I could have talked about those in the book too, but I think it's important for them to have their voice. So again, yeah. I use the term staying in my lane. I will tell you, without fear of contradiction, I sat through that trial. Not a single one of those people that was tried with me, including Stuart Rhodes and Kelly Manners and Jessica Watkins, not a single one of them was guilty of anything that they were charged with. I saw all the evidence.
Yeah, I think it was April or May of that year, I went to a conference. It was one of the first conference post-COVID in Dallas, and Rhodes was there. I got the chance to sit down with Mr. Rhodes for an hour, just him and me. And I'm like, dude, because at this point, I don't think he was charged yet. And I was like, Stuart, tell me what's going on. Because the Oath Keepers had protected me in my political campaign several times without me even asking for it. They had sent protective details when they saw certain threats when I was running for office in Louisiana. I'd seen nothing but good things come out of these people. I mean, they're all firemen, law enforcement, veterans, and those kind of things. And Stuart told me, he seemed like he told me the whole story about where he was at, what he was doing, and he even told me that when the FBI stopped him on the street and took his phone later, he said they're not going to find anything in there because I didn't do anything,
Right.
And I'm sure he was shocked when they eventually rolled him up and charged him with seditious conspiracy,
sure,
of all things, in addition to
right,
those crazies.
Right, Colonel. I'm so glad that you're talking about this because what the Oath Keepers were doing in Washington, D.C. that day was they were augmenting the Secret Service. People don't remember that the Secret Service was coming up with some real bad shortfalls in their ranks. And the special passes that were issued by the Secret Service to members of the Oath Keepers so that they could help escort some of those speakers, some of the ones that I talked about before that were going to go down to Capitol Hill and all that. Those passes were offered up in evidence. Look, this is what we were doing. You'll also remember that just before we all went to trial on this thing, that the Secret Service made the decision to wipe their phones and get a whole new phone system and wipe their Oracle database of all the records of everything that had happened for the last 2 years. Now, that's destruction of evidence.
That sure is destruction of evidence and exculpatory evidence at that, which is a Brady violation. And I'm not a lawyer, and I know that. Well, Tom, we got to take our last break. When we come back, I found a video clip of you talking about what you think was really going on from your professional background. We'll come back in with that because it's a fascinating story and it kind of puts some snippets of information together for me When I watched it, I want to give Tom a chance to talk about that, whether it's in the book or not. We'll be right back with Tom Caldwell.
You woke up with a sore throat and a low-grade fever. You know you are getting sick, so here's your choices. You can get sicker and miss work, try to see a doctor this week, or sit hours in a crowded waiting room at urgent care.
I have a smarter option for you. Open your medical emergency kit, match your symptoms to doctor-recommended prescription in your booklet, and take the right meds now and get well faster.
This is not a first aid kit. It's like having an urgent care in your home. It includes doctor-prescribed medications to treat over 39 medical issues like respiratory infections, strep throat, pneumonia, UTIs, and more.
No waiting to see the doctor and no standing in line at the pharmacy. It's right here.
Every home should have at least one medical emergency kit, and here's how to order.
Go to worldviewhealthcare.com. Your kit to treat dozens of common and serious illnesses is rushed to your door. worldviewhealthcare.com. That's worldviewhealthcare.com.
The emergency kit available at worldviewhealthcare.com. Make sure you don't have to go to urgent care. I got pneumonia. I didn't have to go. I took this last year. Stayed at home, went to bed.
I think what it really is a consequence of the thing called the Strategic Implementation Plan for Countering Domestic Terrorism. You'll remember that the Tulsi Gabbard has made that thing public. She did that shortly after President Trump was inaugurated. That thing was being built in November and December of 2020 while President Trump was still in office, by the same people that made that transition in the intelligence community and in various departments and administrations in the United States government. And in that, what was significant, what your viewers are going to want to know, is that it represented the first time in American history that our government prioritized investigating and neutralizing U.S. citizens over foreign terrorists and their operations in this country. And they prioritized what they called religious zealots, people who question anything that had to do with COVID or the COVID lockdowns. They prioritized people who protested at abortion clinics. They prioritized people who raised their voice at PTA meetings because they were concerned about the indoctrination of our children. It's all in writing, and it's there for anybody to read.
It's all in writing. It was a government plan, folks. You need to be reminded of that periodically. And my guest today is that man, Tom Caldwell, who wrote the book, The Mouths of the Wicked, to talk about his experience of being totally unjustly charged, put in solitary confinement, had his veterans' benefits stolen and taken away from him, his wife almost killed in the unwarranted, no intelligence to back it up, in Rob Manus's opinion. And I know a thing or two about this kind of stuff, to back up that level of force and risk to use on an elderly couple that has served their country, that's minding their own business, just because they showed up to listen to a president and they sat and watched some things happen that they didn't even see any violence. And Tom, I'm glad you talked about that, because there, it was a plan. And the government, before the election, had put pressure on Facebook and those kind of social media CEOs to suppress conservative speech. Because I know, because my website was making about $9,000 in revenue, raw revenue, at the end of September. And I got a note from Facebook saying on the October 1st, 2020, we're going to suppress your website on our platform. And that's where most of my revenue was coming from. And it's never been back. Never been back ever since then. So there was all of this government activity leading up to this, that really set the stage to trick people inside the government that something was happening that wasn't happening, wasn't it?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I'm an intel guy, so you've had intel guys and gals working for you, Colonel, and you expect them to do their homework, to do their research, and present things to you in a cogent and clear way so you can make the decisions that you need to make. And right. I have written extensively after studying this thing and all of the releases from Tulsi Gabbard. She's a hero as far as I'm concerned. And the stuff that's there, I talked about it in that clip that you just showed, so I shan't repeat it. It is so maddening, and it's right there in writing. And it gets down into the weeds. They even plan to set up local networks and neighborhoods so that Democrat Party operatives could report on their neighbors if they did something that looked like it might be a terrorist thing. People are speaking out at PTA meetings. I've got all the documentation right here. I keep it close just in case we need to refer to chapter and verse. So it's very maddening.
Did you cover that in the book? I don't think you did. Did you, from what I remember?
I did just a little bit. I did mention that, but I've tried to have things printed like on American Thinker. I've been on Your News and things like that. So I would invite people to go there. I probably ought to send you a copy of some of these things because it saves people a lot of time.
You should write another book about that, Tom. I mean, the American people on both sides of the aisle need to have an understanding of what really happened because, you know, we want our public to see something, say something. If it's real, but we don't want to build an architecture that responds to fake inputs in that way. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you should write a book about that. Well, I got a question from the audience. I want to take that real quick. Shell is our host over there. Go ahead, Shell.
We have Marlon, sir.
Hey, Tom, thanks for coming in and explaining it. You know, it sounds like, Tom, you had some able to defend yourself. What about the guys that couldn't afford it? What about the guys that they reshuffled the deck on their discovery packets, didn't give them the right evidence that was posed against them? How could you possibly defend yourself? These guys had to take the plea deal at that point. I think if they understood how much it cost you to defend yourself, and then, hey, we weren't given the speedy trial, the exculpatory evidence against you. They reshuffled the cards every time, just watching the evolution of the J6 on X. That's what we came up with. So, Tom, it's been great to hear your story, and thanks for coming up. Thank you, Rob. Appreciate bringing me up, sir.
Yeah. Marlon brought up a good point that is something I think you could answer is on the discovery process, what did your attorney face? I mean, he's in the face of fake evidence. So what happened in discovery from your perspective?
Well, and it kept creating more and more fake evidence. I touch in the book on several specific exhibits. And, you know, as an intel guy, if I'm going to talk about specifics, I'm going to make sure that you can fact check me all you want. People might be interested to know, this is a firsthand account. I tell like a friend talking to a friend, but I've got about 24 pages of endnotes. So you can go back and see exactly what we're talking about. But I only picked some of the most egregious and fake tests. Just talking about but it can't coming. We're invent more when we get the evidence that they had brought out. They have a great day and say, we really ripped them. We really showed that they're lying through their teeth. They just invent something new. Hey, we got a new witness. Your viewers are going to love this. I don't talk about the trial without talking about a guy named Abdullah Rashid. Now, dig this. He's not a Middle Eastern man. This is just a moniker that he assumed. We found out that he had had about 45 aliases or so, and he was the key civilian witness against me and the four oath keepers in my trial, had never met any of us, but he gave the key testimony. This is a guy who had been convicted of aggravated sexual assault of a child, and he traded his perjured testimony for a new identity paid for by our tax money. Don't ask me where he is now. He might be in your hometown. But that's the kind of thing they did. And, you know, they did this sort of thing to all the J6ers. Now that I'm free and I'm able to actually be on chat boards and do a little bit of traveling and meet some of these folks, it's amazing to find out that, yes, of course, not everybody had two lifetimes full of savings like Sharon's and Sharon's and mine. Yeah, we lost everything except this little humble farm that we're on. But some of these folks had to take government-appointed attorneys who clearly hated them. I was amazed to find out that other people didn't have access to the supposed evidence. And Many couldn't even tell me the name of their lawyer. That's how infrequently they interface with them. And it takes a real knack, and the DOJ has it, bringing down the whole government on you to get people to swear to something that they didn't do and take a 5 or 6 or 7 year prison sentence as opposed to a 20-year prison sentence because they want to see their children grow up. Yeah. That's the kind of manic stuff that's going on in the Department of Justice. And I tell you what, faced with that, I don't ever put anybody down for taking a plea deal.
Oh, yeah. I don't put anybody down for taking a plea deal. I mean, even General Flynn, I mean, with as much resources as he had, when faced with the reality, he took a plea deal. I don't blame him at all because, look, the government, the federal government's got a 90-plus conviction rate. You know, I think it's over 95% conviction rate. Yes, there's a reason for that. It's because they get a lot of guilty pleas, a lot of them, because they're able to bring all this information to bear. So let me ask you this one last question before we get to the end. You mentioned you still have the farm. Have you been able to raise any funds to try to get some of this back, some of your wealth back? Do you have a give, send, go, that kind of thing where you guys raise funds to pay legal fees and restore your savings and those kind of things?
Well, we were not permitted to have a give, send, go. They singled me out and wouldn't let that happen. Sharon tried to create one of those while I was still in stir. But because people had heard about our story, we've been so blessed, people sending us cards and letters and their favorite scriptural passages and, you know, checks when they could to just kind of help us keep the lights on. It took everything that we had in savings, I will tell you, up to $1 million. And still we were in debt. You know, I mean, freedom's not free, especially when you're fighting the Department of Justice. So it's not exactly the kind of freedom not free that you and I are used to, Colonel. But right now, we're not asking for folks to contribute anything to us. We're so blessed. Sharon and I are never going to be restored. I mean, how are they going to give us our years back? How are they going to keep her from waking up in the middle of the night having that same nightmare that she has over and over again? Most of the time, she can't even sleep in our bedroom anymore because that's where she was when they came. So we're not going to get that back. We're not going to truly be restored, although there's talk about this fund that Congress is fighting, and some people are putting in notice of claims to the government. We've done that, saying, wouldn't you like to do the right thing? We don't expect that to happen. But as far as restoration, I will tell you this. Sharon and I, our love is stronger than it's ever been. Our faith in our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, is stronger than it's ever been. We feel like we have more friends and more family across this country by virtue of people reaching out to us than we ever could have imagined. So we are so much better off than so many other people who we get to meet when we travel. I've been able to speak at the Citadel. I've been able to speak sponsored by the Faith Coalition down in Sebring, Florida. And we get in my creaky old 20-year-old Toyota Highlander, and we make it down the road gasping and puttering all the way, and we speak to wonderful people, and it's worth it. And people come up and just hold our hands and say, you know, we've been pulling for you. We've been praying for you. We had no idea. People in Bernie, Texas, and Detroit, Michigan had prayer groups for us. And so what we want to do is continue to give back. I'm hoping that the book properly gives credit to our Lord and Savior because he pulled us through. Yes, this is a horrible story, but there are so many miracles and there's so much good stuff that happened to us along the way. And Sharon and I, when I was down, she would pull me up and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And she is the unsung hero in all of this, Colonel, if you'll permit me. But I always say, if you want to be happy for the rest of your life, make a Christian woman your wife. Because it worked for me, and she was with me in lockstep. Some J6ers were abandoned by their families.
You're absolutely right, my friend. And I met you guys a couple of times now in person, and it's exactly as you describe it. Thank God. And thank God we have Christians in this country that can see through the lies and see through see through what's coming out of the mouths of the wicked. That's the book. Tell people where they can buy the book at before I let you go, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's available in paperback and ebook. The best place to go is puffinpublishers.com, P-U-F-F-I-N, like the seabird. Puffinpublishers.com, the publishing company that got behind us when the big guys wouldn't do that. You can also find it at bookbaby.com, and now it's going to be available on amazon.com soon.
Outstanding. Well, thanks a lot. Tom Caldwell, author of The Mouths of the Wicked. Get out there and buy this book and support these guys and keep everybody in your prayers. Our country needs it, especially these folks. Tomorrow's Truth Thursday. We'll see you then.